are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 1st, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Capitalism at the New School, Julia Ott, on her piece in Dissent, How Tax Policy Created the 1%. Also on the program today, Trump to announce whether or not we will stay in the Paris Accord this afternoon. Meanwhile, Yemen on the verge of collapse. Seems Devin Nunes unilaterally issues his own subpoenas to compete with the Russia investigation. And special counsel Mueller beefs up on its financial fraud investigation. And Nigel Farage, yes, that Nigel Farage, a person of interest in the ongoing FBI investigation. Meanwhile, Trump exempts his entire senior staff from White House ethics rules. Puerto Rico's public university system under unprecedented assault. Iran has a universal basic income, and it seems to encourage work. A noose found in the African American History Museum in D.C. and the science behind Trump increasing racism in this country. Trump's Twitter followers, almost 50% of them are fake. And $8,000 gets you teenage blood. All that and more.
Wait a second.
On today's.
Hold on. Stop the prophet.
On today's Majority Report. Apparently Putin the other day implied that maybe it was just patriotically minded Russians who could have been involved in the cyber attack last year. Which is actually not terribly far afield from what we've been saying for a while, where it's like, maybe not official guys, just
our system is very blurred. There's all sorts of people. They traffic
steal a
child,
credit card here.
They do a condo in Soho.
Maybe
they
know
the president.
Podesta had his credit card number stolen too.
Oh no, my credit card got stolen too. I knew I should have gotten that free iPad. Why have you given me something free online? Do I need to give you my credit card number? When I think about it in reverse, that doesn't make any sense. Sorry, Hillary. Hello?
Just a reminder, Mom, please do not click on any link that you get in your email. Please.
I think Bernie's
totally... I have to
totally...
honestly remind her that on a...
For real?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's somewhat justifiable, not the, you know, head of a presidential campaign.
Speaking of Mom, Father's Day is just around the corner. I mean, it's actually, what, like 2 weeks away?
Yeah.
Are you looking for the perfect Father's Day gift? Why not go online, save yourself a hassle, get your dad Omaha Steaks. And now for only $49.99, you can get the limited time Father's Day package. When you go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT. You got to do it in the search bar. It's like a little bit, it's a little sleuthy. You go to the search bar, you enter my code REPORT into the search bar, and you get 80% off. You get two filet mignons. 2 top sirloins, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 boneless pork chops, 4 burgers, 4 jumbo franks. Incidentally, I had the 2 filet mignons like last week.
I had the burgers. I ate them right away.
How were they?
Very good.
A 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 1 pound of fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, and out of the 4, I had 1.5. Well, closer to 1.7. It started off, I was just going to have half, and then I had 1, and then I had half of the other one, and then I had, I quartered that.
I want more.
Mila and Saul loved them.
I want more.
1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. All of this for less than $50. This is your summer barbecue, what do you call it? Cachet. If you're looking for a convenient and quick Father's Day gift, go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT in the search bar, add the family gift pack to your cart, and get 80% savings. Grab your dad, fire up the grill. Now, if you want to get your dad, 2 presents, or you want to go a little smaller, this is what you do. And I did this for my dad last year, and frankly, I'm going to do it again.
I'm going to re-up.
Harry's has a special offer for you guys. You know what I feel about Harry's. Every time I shave, it's a small endorsement for Harry's Shavers. You and your dad are both going to love this. Go to harrys.com/majority report. Get $5 off one of their shave sets, including a limited edition Father's Day set. Comes with a stormy gray razor handle, a chrome razor stand, foaming shave gel, 3 replacement blades, and a travel cover, and is packaged in a very sleek, giftable box. You know why I love Harry's? Because A, it gives me a good shave. B, it's significantly cheaper than the razors you get that are locked in those big plastic cases. And it looks nice. I'm an adult now. I mean, just as of recently. And
you've been really maturing over the last couple of months.
It's really true.
Yeah.
So I get my Harry's razors, and I'm getting one for my dad again this year. It worked last year. He was impressed.
Look at the handle and the blade. Thank you, son.
Honestly.
Hello.
It doesn't sound like him.
No, it's you.
Harry's has a 100% quality guarantee. They'll give you a full refund if you're not happy. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now to redeem a special offer for fans of this show. Harry's going to give you $5 off one of their shave sets. This is for a limited time only, so act now. That's harrys.com/majority report for $5 off. Do your dad a favor, do yourself a favor, and support the show. All at one time. All right, before we get to Julia Ott. So apparently, and people have been asking me, why is the White House doing audio-only briefings now? It's not, you know what? It's not stupid. And I'll tell you why. Because, they are stupid. I told Matt, I said, pull the sound of Sean Spicer responding to the whole Kafi V or VV or whatever that thing is. And broadly speaking, I think that's dumb. Listen, occasionally I'll pop an Ambien and I'll write a tweet that I didn't feel so great about, or maybe I'll end up conceiving a child. These things happen on Ambien. It's true. But Sean Spicer's response to this.
I can't sleep too good. Let's make it.
The inability to address the fact that Trump may have just had didn't check his spell check, whatever it is, the inability to admit even the smallest of flaws is fascinating, hilarious. I don't think it impacts his voters at all. We heard that guy the other day on that, the focus group, who just said, I like him because he's real. Well, when he screws up, that makes him just more real, right? And the fact that he's too arrogant to admit that he screwed up makes him more real to these people. Anything he does makes him real. But the point is, this clip is hilarious. But when I told Matt, grab the clip, he's like, is there video of it? Because it's going to be that much funnier if there is. And it's going to get much more traction. And that's why they're doing only audio briefings. Because they realize that it's just not going to play on television in the same way. And they're trying, they're in a ship that is taking on water. And they're doing anything they can to sort of jettison anything that brings it down, right? Like, this is the point in the sinking of the ship where they start throwing, like, the furniture overboard to just keep it from, you know, or the airplane that is flying and has very few fuel and everything goes out the window. But here is Sean Spicer now addressing the, I can't even pronounce it, Covfefe incident.
Covfefe. A decision in the next few days stand.
Will he have a formal cabinet meeting or a formal review before he makes that decision?
That'll obviously be up to the president to decide. Hunter.
Thank you, Sean. Do you think people should be concerned that the president posted somewhat of an incoherent tweet last night and that it then stayed up for hours?
No.
Why did it stay up so long? Is no one watching this?
No, I think the president and a small group of people know exactly what he meant. Blake.
What does he mean?
Blake.
What is Covfefe?
Blake.
No, but you can
Blake.
Itself.
Blake.
Is at this point with terrorists, is it fully removed, fully stay in?
So there it is. Only a small amount of people. Obviously, Trump was sending a signal. He was activating some type of Covfefe cell somewhere.
That's a lie that, if it's true, would be worse.
Yes! Yes! Why is he sending out coded messages on Twitter?
Yeah, don't worry about it. The president's sending a secret code signal to a group of people you don't know about. I think everything's fine here.
The woods are dark and deep. You have many miles to go before you sleep. Wouldn't fit into a tweet. So,
if you don't know what Covfefe means, then you shouldn't be asking the fucking question. Next.
All right. We're going to take a quick break.
By the way, we're all cleared from ethics probes, so suck it.
Yeah, it means go ahead with the complete lack of ethics. You got a waiver. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Julia Ott on how tax policy created the 1%. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act is winding its way through the Senate. And it is the precursor to, and in and of itself, is tax reform. for Republicans, and is the precursor to an even larger so-called tax reform. As such, important to understand one of the key drivers of income inequality, which, of course, is our tax system. On the phone, associate professor of the history of capitalism at the New School and co-director of the Robert Heilbronner Center for Capitalism Studies at the New School, Julia Ott. Welcome to the program, Julia. Let's start with the inequality that we have in this country. I think people are well versed in it, but talk about the context of, I mean, just explain to people what capital gains is before we go into the history, and then I want to talk about the implications of it, or at least how it's reflected in society now.
Sure. So what the piece is about is this really persistent preference that the income tax code has provided for capital gains income over the last century. Very much so. And what I mean by that, when I talk about a preference or preferential treatment, it means that income that individuals, that households make, if they make it from wages and salaries, it's taxed at a higher rate, okay, so you pay more of your income in taxes than you do if you're making salary off of investment income, and that's a capital gain. So investment income may be like, say, for example, the sale of stocks and bonds or trading in stocks and bonds. It could be the sale and trading of derivatives. It can even be, making a profit on your house. Although for most Americans, it doesn't mean that because capital or house profits from house sales are exempt entirely up to a certain threshold. So it's only very, very wealthy people who sell their house for more than $750,000 for a profit are able to then have this additional capital gains preference on the amount of the profit above $750,000. So it can be, you can receive, or income can receive, this different preferential rate. In many different categories of investment. What this means is that people who work for a living and earn wages and salaries versus people who invest or are able to count their income in various different ways as a capital gain rather than a salary or wage income. People who work for a living are always going to be paying more of their money to the government in the form of taxes. And so this, of course, contributes to wealth inequality and income inequality and wealth inequality. And it's interesting that you led off with a reference to the ACA because the ACA was paid for by raising the capital gains tax rate, which meant that the preference got lower. There was still a differential treatment or preferential treatment. Capital gains income still was being taxed more lightly than wages and salaries. But that preference became a little bit smaller, and the government captured a little bit more of investment income from its citizens in order to pay for ACA. Yeah. And that, of course, is what got that, is part of the repeal there. So that's what you're referring to when you say, that the ACA repeal is also, quote, tax, unquote, reform for Republicans right now.
And before we get into the sort of the ostensible theory behind why you want to, and the development of incentives, et cetera. Before we get into that, I have to say that I was, and it's surprising to me always when I read a fact that I hadn't seen before, but 76% of all capital gains, you write, went to households earning more than $1 million. And I think, people assume because we hear that more than 50% of the country have are invested in the stock market. But what people don't realize is that most of those people who are invested in the stock market are invested via their pension fund, which accrues tax free anyway.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, talk about that.
That's
because it just shows that to a large extent, when you really talk about people who trade and are taking profits from the stock market on any given, you know, in any given time period, we're talking about a very concentrated few people.
Right. So today, you know, the numbers that you quoted were correct, that I can go back to them now, 76% of the capital gains benefit, you know, this sort of, they call it a tax, quote unquote, expenditure, which is a little bit confusing. But the idea being like, this is money, the amount of money that the federal government would have collected, but didn't collect because this preferential treatment is in place. It goes to the 1%, you know, it goes to, as you said, 66% of it goes to folks who are making $1 million or more, or households that are. And it should be really, it's important to note that 96% of these households are white households. So there is another racial kind of element to this, a racial inequity that's part of this story, too. Yes, there are all, you know, there's for a century been a series of consistent arguments, consistent but incorrect arguments about why this is a good idea. That's part of why it's still there. But there's also, as you say, over the course of the 20th century, especially the late 20th century, more and more Americans became investors in the stock market. More and more Americans are owning their homes. So you'd think, well, okay, so fine, you know, really rich people get most of this benefit, but you know, everybody gets something. So, you know, and then if you believe arguments about why we need to incentivize investment, then, you know, this is sort of doubly makes sense. And we can get into the arguments in a minute, as you say, but in terms of this kind of argument that, well, it's a mass, you know, the masses enjoy this benefit and not just the upper class. This isn't really true because even though the majority of American households have some kind of investment in the stock market, they are holding most of those investments in tax deferred accounts. So they're accruing over time for retirement purposes, tax free. So they're already getting a tax benefit, right? And so this is not really, you know, hitting them. It's hitting people who are, you know, selling and buying stocks outside of those kinds of accounts, right? And those are very, very wealthy people who've maxed out their tax-free, right? I mean, there's only a limit to how much money you can put right in one of these tax-free accounts. So these are people who, like, they're not saving for retirement per se in a tax-free account. This is like money above and beyond that. Similarly, yes, they're, I mentioned this before, Americans are able to enjoy tax-free profits from the sale of their home up to a certain amount. And I actually gave the wrong number earlier. It's $250,000 for a single and $500,000 for a married couple. Well, most Americans, you know, if you're living in Manhattan like I am, it doesn't seem like this, but really most Americans, when they profit on a house sale, which by the way has been accruing its value over time tax-free because you don't, you know, yearly have to pay the tax bill for, you know, either rent that you didn't pay or, you know, profit, like the rise in your house on a given year, right? All of that's been accumulating tax-free over time. But it's already, for most, the majority of Americans who are lucky enough to have that kind of a profit, they're already getting a huge tax break there. So again, this capital gains preference that would hit above, it would affect the income, the capital gain from a house sale above $500,000. You know, that's going to a very few people who, you know, have a house profit, a house sale profit above what the exempted amount is anyway.
All right. And I just want to put a pin in, and we'll get to this just in a moment, in the sort of the idea that, well, society benefits from it, even if it accrues. But I do want it to, because you do mention this, and this is, this is something that we raise on this program quite a bit. You write, it encourages corporate executives to take stock-based compensation. And this, we've done a couple interviews with Bill Lozonik from UMass, who has done extensive research on the implications of that shift in capital gains and what it did to the corporate governance.
That's right.
By C-suite people and by board of directors on short term, on basically running their corporations as cottage industries because their money is just made on how the stock is performing. So that may mean buybacks. That may mean layoffs to increase profits short term with no long term vision for the company, because that's not where these individuals make their money. And so we can,
exactly,
particularly in the context of the stock market, the whole argument, it seems to me, about capital gains is worse than bull crap, I guess, is really the way to put it. But all right, so walk us through how this came to be. And there's a surprising, well, maybe not so surprising, racial element to this as well.
Yeah, maybe unrealized racial element or unappreciated racial element. Well, the thing that interested me about the capital gains tax preference is that it's been around ever since the United States had an income tax. And this was a little, it's always, this preference has always existed. And as a historian, that's sort of interesting that it's persisted for 100 years. After the First World War, Americans had become a mass investment society in some sense, because so many millions of Americans had invested in war debt. So in the debates about the Revenue Act of 1921, and this is taking place in the context of post-war labor strife and racial violence and, a deep and painful recession, the idea that investors in deserved this kind of, added reward through the tax code, that the tax policy should preference and privilege the investor, that first emerges and it gets written into the tax code in 1921. The surprising thing is that it can endure for the next, say, 60, 70 years, at a time in which income, the tax rate on earned and waged incomes becomes very progressive, right? So this happens in the New Deal. It happens in the post-war period. The top rates, which means the rate of income tax charged on the highest wage and salary incomes, reach as high as 91% in the post-war period. But there's always this big preference because capital gains income is already taxed much, much, much less. So the question is, well, why does that happen? And this is where kind of the racial element comes in. In the 1930s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, there's kind of always this trade-off where, Democrats kind of control Congress, and there's always this trade-off where politicians are able to maintain high tax rates on this wage and salary income. And the trade-off is that there'll be this preference for capital gains income. Now, you might understand how Northern Republicans, financial and industrial interests, people who are investors like that, why they would take this trade-off and think this trade-off was a good thing. What was a little bit more surprising is that the folks behind it were not, Northern Republicans, kind of representatives from New York City or some other kind of financial, center of the country. But it was really, folks in the Deep South, politicians in the Deep South who were committed segregationists. And if you think historically about it, it makes a lot of sense, because in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, if you're talking about people who have investments, if you're talking about people who have a stock portfolio, and you're talking about people who own their homes, mm-hmm. okay, because we have to think about redlining, we have to, all of this stuff that kept African Americans out of property markets, not because they weren't working hard and trying to save, but because policies and practices were, racist, openly racist. And so if you think about the capital gains tax preference, where it comes from historically, who sponsored it, who protected it, it was really intended to promote not just white privilege, as so much of sort of mid-century liberal policy did, like things like redlining, right, as just mentioned before, but also this is white privilege for very rich white people, right? So I like to call it the white 1%. The capital gains tax preference is not just tax policy in favor of the 1%, but specifically for the white 1%. And we see that today. It's reflected in that statistic I mentioned earlier, that 96.1% of the people who receive that 76% of the benefit, they are white. And it's because wealth and investment accumulates across generations. So if you're a white person whose family was benefiting from this because even that, you know, they owned a home in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they were able to get a little bit of a stock portfolio over generations, you know, that initial advantage, which was a racial advantage, gets amplified through the capital gains tax preference, right? Because then income or profits that you're making on those investments that your parents or your grandparents made is taxed more less heavily, and you can save more of it and reinvest more of it. And so that tax preference allows that initial advantage to compound itself over time. And it's reflected in the tremendous wealth gap that we see between Black Americans and white Americans.
Okay. So there's a couple of things that I just want to make note of is that, one, it occurs to me that there's an analog between the imposition of, or I should say, the reduction in the value that is placed on investment versus labor. You can see an analog in even things like Social Security, where certain professions were left out of the Social Security
That's right.
system that were heavily populated by African Americans or by women in a lot of instances. And that's a legacy that continued for quite a while, you know, whether it was, like, I think, home health care workers or mm-hmm. home workers or agricultural
workers.
And
mm-hmm. that's right.
And now, was at that time, you're not talking about as much about finance. I mean, so the argument, it seems to me, in 1921 is you still have even like a better argument that, well, we're building industry theoretically. When we talk about capital gains, it's actually going into investments that theoretically are going to provide more value to society at large. And if the price that we pay is that rich people get richer, that's okay, because it's sort of and you talk about there is a there was one guy, and I think it was maybe it was Bailey or who was sort of the precursor. I guess it was Emil Schramm.
Yeah.
Talk about him.
Yes.
The precursor to almost the Laffer curve, which...
We're seeing the Laffer curve come back in a big way nowadays, right?
Well, we see it in Kansas, and we're going to see it. And I'll just add, too, that one of the big things in Kansas they did was basically say that we're going to have no tax, essentially, or we're going to have a reduced tax on all S-corps, where individuals can become corporations. And a huge chunk of what you can pull out of an S-corp is capital gains as opposed to wages
That's
that
right.
you're paying yourself. And this
That's
is
right.
Donald Trump's idea as well. But all right, tell us about Schramm.
Right. So, I mean, Schramm is, he's an interesting figure because he had been, this is historical nerddom at work here, but bear with me. He had actually been a leader, kind of the second in command of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was the agency of the New Deal that basically rescued capitalism in the 1930s by extending like all of these government loans and guarantees to all kinds of industries all across the nation. And in the post-war period, the New York Stock Exchange offers Emil Schramm, he makes an offer that they can't refuse. He can't refuse, basically. And he's making being paid like the highest salary in the country to come on board, be the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. And his big duty is just public relations and spreading this gospel of, the power and positive power of investment, basically a Laffer trickle down kind of a thing. This is actually a set of theories that the exchange and other members of the financial community developed way back in the 19 teens when they're kind of first under onslaught by progressive reformers. And then it comes back in a big way in the Great Depression and after World War II, when there's, a host of legislation and the federal government is like very much involved. As I mentioned before, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, very involved in financing American enterprise. So the stock exchange, you know, continues this like great ideological mission. It's not just the stock exchange. There are many other figures involved. And they make these new alliances like the Southern segregationists and sort of convince them of their way of thinking about the economy. And the idea is that we'll call it trickle down. You prioritize investors through capital gains, tax preferences, and other kinds of policies. Because if investors can keep more of their money, they will make new investments. They will recycle it in their economy, and they will make good bets on new enterprises that are going to develop innovation and create jobs. And this all sounds great. And so this is the argument, as I was saying before, that's separate from the argument that lots of people benefit this because we're a nation of investors. This is a second argument about like the broad, the way the world works, which was a later supply-sider, Jude Wininski's way of describing it, the way the economy works, the way the world works in a more general sense. So the idea is whether you're an investment or an investor or not, like everybody benefits. The economy is healthier, stronger, it grows faster, more innovated if you prioritize investors and investments. The problem with this, well, there's many problems with this argument. One of these problems with this argument is historically it's not true that private investment and private investors are really responsible for great break, you know, are solely responsible for great breakthroughs in technology and things of this nature, and innovations in various different ways. Federal government has always played a very strong role. Research universities have always played a very strong role. But the second problem with this set of arguments is that you can't force investors to go out there and make smart bets on like new and promising and, you know, employment generating enterprises. And what we actually see private investors tending to do, and that this is, you know, an individual wealthy person, this is a pension fund, this is a hedge fund. What we usually see them do is, you know, use the money that they've accumulated, you know, to chase after whatever asset, you know, class is currently fashionable and experiencing a bubble, right?
Right.
And this is, bursts, I mean, and all of that wealth that disappears.
And this is the problem that we had in the buildup of the real estate market going into 2008 was,
built up in the aftermath of the dot-com bubble
right.
in the late 1990s. So we just see this kind of again and again. Where the, and we see it very much now. We see it in the corporate scene too. Going back to what William Lozonik was talking about with you earlier, that corporations are actually putting more money back into the stock market than they are using financial resources to build their business. That
and
private
isn't,
investors.
Isn't,
yeah.
Can I just add? Isn't it also the case? I mean, as a third problem in terms of that argument, is that. Investors are going to chase profits where they find them. The idea that the money's not, we're not burning the money. I mean, it's not going away, right? There's still going to be the same amount of investment society-wide if the government is spending the money. And the fact is that the private investor doesn't need more incentive to invest beyond the idea that they're going to make profits.
That's right. So the idea being they need this extra incentive that if they make a capital gain, the government won't take as much of it. Or, you know, other ways in which the government might encourage them to do that. But they need that, you know, or else they won't take that risk. I think we can all say that just doesn't make sense. If people have great ideas and want to start businesses, they're going to do it, not just to make profits because, you know, they believe in the skills that they have. They think that they have good to do in the world through their work. I mean, there's lots of reasons why people start businesses. The capital gains tax doesn't really even, you know, it's privileging the investor. I mean, one could imagine a lot of different ways to encourage entrepreneurialism, right? To encourage, you know, smart people to start new enterprises to solve social problems and make money in the meantime. But that's not even what the capital gains tax does, really. It incentivizes the people who are, rewards the people who are ostensibly supposed to be delivering money to that entrepreneur. But guess what? In reality, those people aren't even doing that today. Those people, instead of going to the entrepreneurs and investing in these new enterprises, what they're really doing is going to the stock market, or as you say, the real estate market, or whatever it is, the oil market, you know, oil futures or whatever, and putting their money there, kind of trying to chase the hot returns and chase whatever's going to make them a lot of money very, very quickly, right? So that's, you know, that's a lot of it's a lot of trading, it's a lot of speculation. It's not the investment. And back in the day, in the 19th century, people were careful about using words to say, you know, speculation here, investment there. You know, this has been collapsed a lot in the last century. And so, you know, hedge funds don't make investments. That's not what they do. They trade. Right.
It's gambling. It's just a basic, it's a gamble. It's a bet, right? I mean, that is what it is. It just has maybe slightly better odds or more informed. But, you know, I went to the racetrack this weekend for the first time, the horse races, not terribly dissimilar as to when I attempt to buy a stock. In terms of what
well,
I'm
what
doing.
The, you know, what the industry would say, you know, well, you need that kind of trading because you need liquid markets. So when people want to get in and out of an investment, or, you know, they can do that. You need those kind of markets because they generate prices, and things need to be priced in an economy. Capital assets, financial assets need prices. And, you know, that may all be true. But the question is, like, how much as a society do you want to pay for it? Right. Like, are we willing to let all of this income to the federal, you know, that would be revenue for the federal government, I should say, just disappear? And it is the second largest sort of, benefit. It's the second largest, again, they call it an expenditure, sort of amount of money that the federal government would collect if not for the preference. It's the second biggest expenditure or kind of money foregone. And it's quite large. It's I should have a number here someplace, but
I think it was over $100 billion annually. I think you had written here, but let me ask you this. I mean, do you have a sense of, in terms of the over financialization of our economy? I mean, is this knowing that we've had this basically for as long as we've had income tax in this country?
That's right.
And I presume at the beginning it was a purely political, I mean, it was a political calculation that, you know, in trying to birth the idea of an income tax, we've got to basically make sure that the really wealthy people aren't hurt by it. On some
well,
level.
Not, I mean, not exactly. The income tax comes in 1913, and these different forms of income are not actually separated at first, just everything gets taxed the same, which, you know, why that isn't still the case, right? I mean, why we don't talk about that as a possibility is something that I'm trying to kind of push forward. But it comes in 1921, and again, it's in this context where, you know, millions and millions of Americans have become investors in federal government debt that was used to pay for the war for the first time, and really a lot of controversy and really very acrimonious debates over, you know, what should we do now? Should we abolish the should we abolish the income tax entirely? Should we put on a sales tax instead? Should we, you know, carve out exemptions for different forms of income to kind of encourage different industries? Lots of labor and racial strife, very bad recession. And the capital gains preference for investors, like individual investors will get this tax preference, it's kind of a compromised position, because it's sort of made possible that historical moment because now the idea of an individual investor has a different kind of meaning. It's no longer seen as something that only plutocrats do. It's something that all Americans did during the First World War to support the military effort. So it kind of like it makes a different kind of sense in that post-war moment. But things change dramatically in the decades ahead, right? So, you know, what made a lot of sense in that moment, you know, it has outcomes, it generates outcomes over decades that need to be really reexamined then, the reasons why we have this and whether we should continue to have it.
And I was also struck by just how long, I mean, we have throughout, you know, this notion of, like you say, of ownership, and that takes us all the way to the early aughts, I guess, when George Bush was attempting to usher in the ownership society, where we would all be owners and we would all be paying capital. It would only be capital gains tax for everybody.
Yeah.
That didn't work out so well.
It didn't work out so well, but, you know, I don't think we've made all that much progress away from it either. I mean, you know, the alternative to the ownership society is a kind of, you know, social democracy kind of model where people don't have to rely and depend upon, you know, what they do or what they can be or what they can achieve as, you know, individual investors to secure, you know, economic well-being for themselves and their family, but they can kind of come up with, you know, more collective solutions to these problems, to, you know, funding your retirement, educating your children, you know, maintaining yourself and your family if you fall on hard times in various different ways, your healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in the past, sometimes these collective solutions come from government programs, but also in the past, employers have played more of a role. Again, this was sort of, you know, not a racially equitable arrangement necessarily, as you said before, for many decades. A lot of the government programs were racist in intent and in outcome. And in the past, corporate programs and corporate benefits were as well, right? So, you know, I'm not trying to say one's perfect and one's not, but the idea is, you know, forcing Americans or creating a situation where the only way in which you weather the storms of you know, economic life for yourself and your family is through private markets,
right,
is really not a model that's going to work for most people.
Well, it's interesting because that I think it's best encapsulated by you make the point that we went from Huey Long, who demanded that Americans, quote, share our wealth, to his son, Senator Russell Long, who encouraged them to own your share. And that, I think, shows the fundamental difference between
the trajectory.
The trajectory and
the fundamental reversal.
Indeed.
But I think what's interesting in that trajectory, I mean, Russell Long, bless his heart, like, really, you know, he actually was, you know, a right-hand man with LBJ, and he came around on civil rights legislation, and he really actually very much believed in this was like the future of economic citizenship. And he's responsible for, you know, a lot of different other kinds of policies, you know, all of these tax policies of privilege investment, for example, apart from the capital gains tax, like the tax deferred accounts and all that kind of thing. He has a hand to play in all of that kind of stuff. But I think it's interesting historically in the United States that you kind of needed somebody like him. You kind of needed somebody whose, you know, family legacy and the Long families, like a pig political dynasty in Louisiana, you needed these kinds of folks to say these kinds of things from within the Democratic Party and not from within the Republican Party, right? It's like sort of too obvious if it comes from over there. You needed this stuff to cross party lines. And be able to, you know, tap into these historical, you know, political discourses, I think, for it to work and for it to work as long as it has. And, you know, the whole point of the piece is to sort of bring this to light and hope that, you know, now's the time that we can reexamine it.
Important time to pay attention to it. Julia Ott, the piece is How Tax Policy Created the 1% in Dissent magazine. We will link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, folks. This is what, I mean, the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act is all about these capital gains taxes. I mean, there's some other taxes thrown in there, but at the end of the day, this is the big prize. And then if you ultimately get that repeal and replace, that sets up tax reform. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say it's dead in the Senate. Well, I also remember when we were saying it's dead in the House. So keep an eye on that. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It's just pennies a day. Talk about, there should be a capital gains tax for investing in the Majority Report. I don't know exactly how we would work that out.
Okay, Rachel.
We'll do a, there should be an earned income tax, capital gains tax.
I don't know if you want to get into an earned income tax credit for becoming a member. We got like rebate like a third of the membership or something.
We're still going to work it out. But folks, we could do all this work on coming up with some type of tax incentive to become a member. But
it should be deductible.
It should be. Well, I mean, become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy stuff from Amazon or jet.com, and if you haven't tried out Jet, you should really do try out. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Find the link, click on it, use that link when you're purchasing things, and we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Quick break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll take your phone numbers. We'll take your phone numbers, and we'll take your phone calls. We have some sound from Rick Santorum, Neil Farage, apparently on Fox and Friends this morning.
Nigel.
Man.
Stop confusing me with my brother Neil. He also hates immigrants.
They actually brought him in to talk about Kathy Griffin.
Well, I mean, what Kathy Griffin did was just
he was
stunning.
Remote, but
oh, he was remote?
Yeah.
They didn't fly him in? It's unbelievable. You know, I don't know how many times, and maybe we should pull the tapes, of me saying we should not vote for Kathy Griffin to be the DNC chair. It was just a mistake from the beginning.
And now she's starting death squads.
That's right.
But there's your paramilitary, Kathy Griffin. How about her? Everyone talks about the
she's
guys.
She's great.
That, yeah, yeah. They stabbed a couple of losers on a train in Portland. What about Kathy Griffin?
She's it really is people. Amazing how much traction Kathy Griffin doing this has gotten versus, let's say, Ted Nugent or... You know, contemporaneously.
Yeah, Ted Nugent's an entertainer. Get it?
That's actually the Dave Rubin joke, I think, that he...
That was sounds like a very Dave Rubin joke.
Well, he was... You know how adamant he is about free speech.
Of course. Free
and
exchange
so
of ideas.
He was one of the first guys on Twitter to go out and defend her. He didn't agree with what she was saying, of course. But no. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. That was not him. Right. He just went on to say, like, I didn't like her show with Anderson Cooper.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a deep, incisive insight from Dave Rubin, as always. God.
When you have to say something.
You know what? And I'll tell you.
Well, the best one was the O'Reilly one. You remember that one, right?
No. But when you, oh, yeah.
That was like, I don't know exactly what happened, but I knew it's pretty toxic that people celebrate someone else's downfall. I wanted like Dave Rubin through
right.
history.
I'm sure.
I don't know what the whole Hitler deal was, but I think it's pretty toxic
well,
to celebrate
he did write
someone
that,
killing
to be fair,
himself in a bunker.
To be fair, he did write that about Kathy Griffin. Oh, no, wait, no, he didn't.
Yeah,
no, he didn't.
No.
But I will say this, too, is that because I have kids, you know, like an 11-year-old kid, you can't, you know, when she was like 9 or 10, we're not going to take her out to like 1 in the morning partying. So I have seen some of that Kathy Griffin, Anderson Cooper thing. And it's the only thing worth watching on New Year's if you're going to watch one of those shows.
Oh, wow.
It actually is sort of fun because she would just really embarrass Anderson Cooper.
Oh, like when she would pull out like a decapitated Trump head and Anderson would be like, whoa, that's a lot.
Exactly. All right, we get
if she pulled out a decapitated Trump head on CNN
awesome.
New Year's, she would be my favorite entertainer.
That would be awesome. I mean, it was a bad business decision on her part. I think that was, I mean, the whole thing, let's be honest. I mean, the whole thing from get-go was just a business.
It didn't work well.
Yep.
I just don't understand why they're saying that Barron Trump saw it and thought it was real. Yeah. I mean, he's 11.
Bull.
Come on. Is something wrong with him or something?
Well,
he wasn't watching it. That's no a lie.
Comment. I know it's either a lie or just. But like even very
even the
troubling.
Lie itself is even sort of like
very troubling.
The lie itself is the type of lie you would tell if you didn't know any 11-year-olds.
Right. Barron was upset. Right? Have you people have no fucking conscience?
I mean,
even a 5-year-old
Saul would look at that, and I don't think he would be like, "Wait, what?"
You'd be honest. You showed it to Saul.
Oh, no, I showed it to Saul, and he was happy.
He said,
but
he
I'm
said
saying,
I don't,
if
I don't
he
think
was
that this
concerned.
Is a good move for Kathy Griffin's career.
All can kids I are have different, some, but I mean, you're talking like 4 years and below. There's an 11-year-old who thinks that might be real. Oh, God.
First of all, these are the same troubling. People who laughed at images of Obama as a witch doctor. Secondly, I think it was a miscalculation on her part. And third, can I get some mozzarella sticks, Dad?
Barron's going to have a tough time with a lot of the representations of his dad in the future. I think he'll probably learn to...
What if Barron sees his dad?
To be fair, he's also probably has problems with the actual real thing.
The problems with Barron and me started well before I destroyed the planet.
We got to have Larry Murphy on the show, but he left a message on my show. He did Melania's voice calling Donald, where she's like, Barron saw the picture. He's upset.
A picture
he's like,
of
Kathy. All right, okay. It's not me. I'm alive. See you at Christmas.
Like, wow, this kid really isn't bright.
Right. Yeah. Not very bright.
Not
anyways,
a smart kid.
Tell him it's fine. But see you Christmas time.
Yeah. But tell him that very bad move from Kathy Griffin's career perspective.
All right. We got to head into the fun half. Folks, and I really do want to thank. Where is it? Who is it that sent this? Okay. Little Gray send in this. This version of La Poupée, which has been retitled Situation Sad, was by Finnegan's Wake from 1966. This is awesome. I love this one. All right, we'll see you in the fun half.
Sad. She said no.